Barry.
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 You getting it?
Barry Weiss.
My God, she's got it. If we didn't hear you come in there, hello, I'm Adrian Dobb.
And I'm Moira Donegan.
And whether we like it or not, we're in bed with the right.
So, Adrian, today we are back with part two. It's Barry the sequel, Barry 2, A Very Weiss Ascent.
Nice. Now with 100% better pronunciation of the name of the person we're making fun of.
So when we left off last week, Barry had just quit her job as an opinion editor at the New York Times after making a career there as sort of like an anti-woke provocateur. And she publishes this open letter when she resigns saying that the Times, and by implication, other ones of these like mainstream institutional news sources, were hostile to conservatives in a way that distorts their depiction of the truth. Today, we're going to see Barry launch her own independent publication, a newsletter she at first calls Common Sense, but then later rebrands as an opinion outlet called The Free Press. She's going to ingratiate herself with the billionaire tech elite. She's going to get acquired by the billionaire Ellison family, the founders of Oracle, and become the editor-in-chief of CBS News as a conciliation to the right after the Ellison's Skydance Corporation buys Paramount. And we're going to see her now, at this moment in March of 2026, eyeing even more conquests as she looks to become an editorial leader across an even bigger territory of media outlets as the Ellisons seek to buy up Warner Brothers and its properties at CNN and HBO and really consolidate their control of the media.
Yeah, that's right. There's that famous meme of a tiny little domino, and then there's a row of like intensely upsized dominoes right behind it. Like Barry Weiss writing that resignation letter is sort of like the reason I wrote the cancel culture panic. And I cannot tell you the number of talks I've given around that book where people are like, well, what about the Barry Weiss letter? Do you disagree with that? And I'm like, oh boy, do I?
Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, we left off last week by talking about that open letter where Barry resigns from the Times. And, you know, she claims to have been bullied by her liberal colleagues for, like, quote unquote, wrong think. And yes, indeed, that is the phrase she used. She compared people being, like, rude to her on Twitter to the authoritarian dictatorship in George Orwell's 1984. And we really made fun of it. We read this letter, like a passage from this letter, like with a little voice like this. I was punished for my phrase and the wrong thing. But we did that because it was stupid, right?
Oh, yeah.
But not everybody mocked this, as you mentioned. Like a lot of people found this letter, you know, really resonant. And they used Barry's departure from the Times as an opportunity to voice their own grievances about the media. So, Adrian, I have here some tweets that were made in response to Barry's departure from the Times in July of 2020. Would you read these?
Sure. This is from Donald J. Trump Jr. This is a must read for everyone. If you want to get a glimpse into today's enlightened media, and in this case, the New York Times, you need to look no further. NYT editor Barry Weiss resigns in stunning fashion and exposes the Times' rampant attacks on anyone who breaks from the far-left narrative. Quote, speak your mind at your own peril. The publisher will cave to the mob. Heartwarming. The worst person you know just made a terrible, terrible point.
Yeah, Donald Trump Jr. very, very moved by this.
Yeah.
As was Senator Ted Cruz, who tweets, wow, if you read only one thing this week, read this eloquent, profound, incisive, and true letter.
Ted really knows from eloquent, profound, incisive, and most of all, true.
The podcaster and conservative man about town, Ben Shapiro, tweets this letter of resignation from Barry Weiss is devastating.
Devastating.
And Brent Bozell. Do you know who Brent Bozell is?
I do, but which Brent Bozell? One, two, three, or four?
I believe this is number three.
Yeah. The bastion of liberal PC culture shows its true colors. Who will be fired for this? Yeah, nice tweet, Brent. Did your ghostwriter crap that one out for you too?
Wait, tell our listeners who Brent Bozell is.
Oh, so Brent Lee Bozell III is, yeah, the third in a line of conservative activists and writers. He founded the Media Research Center, which is a clearinghouse for like liberal media bias kind of stories that then make the rounds on Fox News or on Twitter. He is also the current ambassador, I believe, to the Republic of South Africa.
Yes, and it is not going well. They are trying to get rid of him.
He does, and this is very awkward in South Africa, hate black people.
So this is the caliber of ally that Barry is attracting as she launches away from the New York Times. And amidst this outpouring of right-wing goodwill, she launches her own newsletter, which she initially calls Common Sense. So I think it's important to note that at this time when Barry launches her newsletter in January of 2021, you're really seeing kind of like a flourishing of newsletters. There's these alternative sources of employment to the establishment media outlets emerging on these newsletter platforms because those big establishment media outlets are contracting, right?
Yeah.
They're laying off tons of people at the end of every quarter. It's a bloodbath. They're failing to maintain legitimacy with readers in the Trump era, both on the left and the right, which is, of course, something that Barry facilitated during her time at the Times. And as those jobs disappear, more and more journalists are trying to make it independently with their own newsletters. And a few of them are having a lot of success.
Yeah.
So this is already a pretty established career pivot, especially for the cancels. Barry is just following a script, right? When she leaves the Times, she is following a pre-established route for somebody to go down to make a different kind of media career.
Yeah. Andrew Sullivan walked so that Barry could run.
Yeah, exactly. Right. She reportedly just launches this out of her own home. And that much will be familiar to a lot of us, right? She's a gig worker.
Yeah.
But I think that we have to pause for a second and think about Barry's pivot from establishment to independent media in 2020 and 2021 as having to do with her broader relationships to institutions. Because a lot of people, when they leave these big media companies and then try to make it on their own as independent journalists, they're doing that because there aren't any jobs at these big media companies anymore, right? They're sort of indifferent to the institution or like wish that it was treating its employees a little better. They would probably like to be at a bigger news outlet where they could get health insurance, et cetera, and not have to do everything themselves. But that sort of career path has been taken away from them. And so they're trying to make it in this hardscrabble way on her own. Barry's a little different. She's not just venturing out on her own. She's also making a critique of that establishment outlet. She's now on the outside of the mainstream prestige media and she's looking in. And this is also kind of the posture she took at Columbia. She felt excluded from the prestigious institution. She felt anger and woundedness at that exclusion. And then she launched her own like little institution, Columbians for Academic Freedom, where she felt like she was an insider and she would launch a critique of the big guys, right?
That's also what she did at the New York Times. The bullying she complains about in this letter appears to have been that she was compulsively tweeting out things that people said in closed editorial meetings, which is highly unprofessional behavior. And a lot of what she experiences bullying was people like, Barry, please don't do that. That's really messed up. Or people saying, that's not even true. That's not even what we said.
Yeah, it's also maybe worth mentioning that the New York Times has a really, really strict social media policy that applies to everybody except those in the opinion department, right?
Right.
So when Barry goes on Twitter during her New York Times years and says, oh, this happened at the staff meeting, the New York Times is totally captured by the woke agenda, nobody else who's in that meeting has the ability to go on Twitter and correct the record.
Right.
Because doing so risks their jobs, right? So Barry has sort of like singular access to the public depiction of that workplace at the time. But, you know, this is a pretty common approach to institutions for her, right? I am an outsider. I'm critiquing the institution. I'm challenging the institution. And I don't want to put her on the couch too much. But I think one thing you see with these right-wingers who pay a lot of attention to elite institutions, people who critique universities, who critique the media, is this sort of like longing to be brought back in, right? To defeat this like Oedipal father of the institution that created them, like the Times, like Columbia, and also change and reform that institution and remake them in their own image. So Common Sense, her newsletter, which she later rebrands as the Free Press, isn't so much positioned as like an alternative or competitor to the Times. It's positioned as like the Times' estranged daughter, like trying to shame that bigger institution into changing.
Interesting. I'd nuance that slightly. Yes, there is this kind of attempt to recreate the institution outside of the institution, right? But in the end, you can really tell that Barry, because she is such a dropout, because she spends so little time in these institutions, doesn't really understand them all that well. Being at the opinion side of the New York Times doesn't give you a good insight of what the newsroom works like, right? Being an undergrad at Columbia doesn't give you, sorry, but particularly good insight of what Columbia is like as an institution. So there's also this kind of outsider's view that thinks it's far more savvy and can replicate what it observed at an institution, but without much of the institutional know-how, right? And I do think that like when we get to the University of Austin, that is a school envisioned by someone who doesn't understand what a school functions like, right? And I think the Free Press is if someone tried to come up with a newspaper who's only had cursory experiences with newspapers. And just so that people don't think I'm just bashing conservatives, this is not true for all conservatives. The Daily Caller was Tucker Carlson's attempt to do a right-wing media conglomerate with robust fact-checking from someone who knew how fact-checking worked, who'd done right-wing but pretty esteemed journalistic work. And there he is trying to replicate what he had observed, and he understood the institution. In the end, he ended up not fact-checking that much anymore because he just went completely fucking crazy. But Barry is not that, right? She did not do what Tucker Carlson did and sort of like come out of actual reporting. She comes out of a very passing, glancing familiarity with the things that she's then trying to clone.
Not only is she sort of a tourist in a lot of these elite institutions, just sort of like dipping in for brief periods of a couple years before moving on, she also has a very, very specific kind of media experience, right? Yeah. She's somebody who writes and edits book reviews and writes and edits opinion columns. That is one way to describe my career, right? I am somebody who writes a lot of reviews and I write a lot of opinion pieces. What I do is not investigative reporting. Yeah. It is a totally different set of skills that I have had to learn and try to grow with and acquire, but it's not my wheelhouse to begin with, right? That is not something Barry has ever tried to do. Barry is only an opinion writer, only a reviews writer, only kind of a cultural critic who takes established facts and depict them in a way that is convenient for her agenda or like promotes her worldview. That's different from establishing the facts in the first place. And when she gets to CBS, that difference of experience is going to really challenge her credibility with the people who are now working for her.
Yeah.
So all that said, she establishes this newsletter in early 2021, and it doesn't exactly find its footing right away. So Barry launches Common Sense about 5 months after leaving the Times. She leaves the Times July 2020. She launches her newsletter January 2021. And in a bit of foreshadowing, her time at this outlet, first Common Sense and then the Free Press, is almost exactly contemporaneous to Biden's presidency.
Oh, that's right. Wow. Yeah.
She launches her newsletter right as he's entering office, and she moves up and out and onto greener pastures not that long after she leaves, right? So the Free Press, under Barry Weiss's sole leadership, is really a product of the Biden era. And it's an artifact a little bit.
I was upset about Biden being president, so I started a newsletter.
In these first like couple months and weeks of her newsletter, she's sort of trying to do the same cancel culture hucksterism that she was doing at the Times. You know, she looks to amplify stories of individuals who claim that they have been canceled by the woke mobs that control elite institutions. So one of her first pieces, her very first pieces, is an interview with this anti-vax bodybuilder woman who claimed that Disney had fired her from a minor role she had on the TV show The Mandalorian, also known as Baby Yoda, because she was a COVID skeptic and like wouldn't take the vaccine.
Wait, is that Gina Carano?
Yes, yeah.
But that's not a minor role, though. I think she had a major role, though I have not seen much of The Mandalorian.
Oh, you should watch it because Baby Yoda's in it and he's very cute.
He's very cute.
So this is also a little bit of foreshadowing, right? Because she's already very early in her career at an independent outlet, opening the door to like anti-vaxxers, COVID skeptics, and these like proto-MAHA types.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting too. One of the things about Barry's influence with the Free Press is that like it's very clearly not fact-checked. And one way to think about this kind of crop of preoccupations that you've outlined here is that those are things we tend to be okay with not robustly fact-checking, right? If you do a full-on piece about a senator who, like, I don't know, is having an affair or stole money, like, you better fucking fact-check that shit. Saying, I was canceled by Disney for my cool views, right? Like, no one's ever going to push back. You're going to be fine. And this MAHA style, like, it often flies under lifestyle, even though it's deeply political. And therefore, too, you can sort of say random shit in print or online without really exposing yourself. So like it's both her new perch and her old obsessions reinforcing each other mutually, I feel like.
I would say at The Guardian, my opinion columns are fact-checked, which thank God, I think it does a little bit of a disservice to writers at places like the New York Times, where at the time that Barry was there, opinion columns were not fact-checked.
Right.
But that's another thing about being an independent journalist is that, you know, you set your own standards
yeah.
when you are the sole proprietor and the only editorial authority, right?
Yeah.
So meanwhile, Barry seems to really want to be on TV. According to Variety in the summer of 2021, so just a couple, you know, months after she launches her newsletter, she is lobbying pretty hard to be a host on the women's daytime panel talk show, The View.
Oh, wow.
She had been a guest a couple of times on The View before, but her agents at CAA were really gunning to get her a contract. And it didn't go exactly the way she wanted. Adrian, would you read this little bit of highlighted text here?
I didn't know this, so I'm excited to read this. In the summer of 2021, the producers of The View cast a wide net to find their token conservative co-host after Meghan McCain's exit. Barry Weiss, who had guest hosted a few episodes of the panel show and was making waves with her just-launched news outlet, The Free Press, wanted the job, and her then-CAA agents lobbied hard. But Weiss didn't test well with audiences who didn't understand her centrist, right, contrarian politics. In fact, her focus group scores were so low that she wasn't invited back to guest host, according to insiders. Instead, Alyssa Farah Griffin, a former Trump White House director of strategic communication, landed the gig. That's funny.
It is pretty funny. And I mean, I dwell on this early failure at The View, not just for the sake of mocking Barry, although obviously we are, but to show that at this point in 2021, she doesn't really have a plan.
Yeah.
I think it's easy with the benefit of hindsight to think that Barry left the Times with this grand vision of how she's going to conquer media. But that's not what happened. What happened is that she failed upward to where she is now as the editor-in-chief of CBS. Because at the time, she was trying to get a much lesser job and failing. So it's easy to look at her as an evil genius, but one thing I'm trying to do on today's episode is show that she's actually kind of a useful idiot.
Yeah, that's true for a lot of wingnut welfare, isn't it? In some way, these people are extremely interchangeable in what they bring to the table. As with The View, right? Like, we need a conservative, anyone with a pulse. Do they have to be charming? Do they have to be interesting? Well, this person is like negative charming, so we can't use her. But it'll just be some communication director from the Trump White House. I always think of the grab machine at the fair. Like, you're just waiting to be grabbed by the great conservative media claw in the sky by some billionaire who happens to like your shit. And until that moment, you're just writing your dumb Substack. Again, nothing against Substacks, but write your dumb Substack and like try to get a guest spot somewhere and like maybe get quote unquote canceled for the right thing. And then suddenly like a sugar daddy will materialize.
And it's about to materialize for Barry because at the time, her newsletter, Common Sense, was already doing pretty well. So she reportedly passed the mark of $80,000 a year in annual subscriptions within the first week of her launch. If I was a betting woman, I'd say that $80,000 a year is about like ballpark what she had been earning at the Times.
Yeah.
By the autumn, she has 100,000 subscribers. That's really pretty good. And she starts staffing up. So now it's not just her in her apartment anymore. Within a couple months, she already has a staff of 5 at Common Sense. So she starts thinking about the newsletter as something that she can build off of and expand. And to that end, she starts looking for funders, and she finds them in Silicon Valley.
Chucker!
When we ended our podcast last week, we marked Barry's departure from the Times in the summer 2020 as a pivot moment that really changed her career. I actually think the end of 2021 and the beginning of 2022 is when Barry becomes what she is now. And here I want to shout out Claire Malone at The New Yorker, who's a really talented media reporter over there. She did a great and like very thorough profile of Barry a couple months back that covers this stretch of several months of like late 2021, early 2022, better than I've seen done elsewhere. Because around this time, Barry does what Americans frequently do when they are looking to reinvent themselves. She moves to California.
California, Max.
The place where people go to stop thinking critically and get a lot of money from Republicans.
That's why we're here.
Yeah. So Barry had lived off and on the West Coast before. So in 2018, as we mentioned last time, she began dating the New York Times reporter and California heiress, Nellie Bowles, who lived in Berkeley. So Barry starts spending a lot of time with her there in Berkeley. The two got married in 2020, and they apparently spent a big chunk of the pandemic shuffling between a Nellie Bowles home in Los Angeles and a Barry Weiss family summer home in Cape Cod. Must be nice.
Wow.
I spent the pandemic in a 700-square-foot one-bedroom apartment in Bed-Stuy. It would have been nice to have private homes on both coasts. But around this time, Barry becomes a fixture at dinner parties in Los Angeles. And she gains the attention of some of the biggest investors in Silicon Valley, who really feel that her anti-woke politics reflects their own frustrations and aspirations to reorient culture away from wokeness and from the social movements of the 2010s towards something different at the beginning of the Biden era.
The vibe shift.
Yes, the vibe shift. Right. Adrian, would you like gloss Silicon Valley right-wing radicalization?
So there are a couple of things at play. There's been a right-wing element in Silicon Valley all along, but for a long time it was sort of covered with at least gestural libertarianism. And that sort of becomes pretty threadbare in the wake of Me Too and Black Lives Matter, where these people who were like, oh, well, we just don't want the government to get involved in our companies, had to come out and say, like, no, we actually think that the whiteness and the maleness of our companies is not a problem. They had to be honest and say that they thought men were better than women and that white people were better than black people. That did not make them friends. There's also the fact that COVID was a huge shock for Silicon Valley. And I should be careful. If we have listeners in the San Francisco Bay Area, when I say Silicon Valley, I don't mean every tech worker. I mean, like, people at the very top echelons, the people that sort of get noticed in media for being at the top of this industry, and especially people who have already kind of exited the industry and are now investing. So this would be very wealthy, very strange VCs above all. And for a lot of them, COVID was this kind of double whammy of indignity. First, they had to stay home like everybody else, right? The person famously radicalized by that is Elon Musk. They were being treated like everyone else, and to them, that felt like tyranny. But also, and this is something that maybe people outside of Silicon Valley didn't notice so much, they sort of came into the pandemic crisis thinking, well, we're going to solve this the way we solve everything else, right? Like, we're going to put it on the blockchain. Like, all these buzzwords sort of be trotted out. Turns out, viral research is not a pitch meeting, and the virus didn't care that they had all this AI power they were going to train on this virus. And in the end, it was doctors being like, hey, we should lock this shit down. And then other doctors being like, hey, I think we found first a vaccine and then a treatment for this thing. That rankled them, I think. And so this must have been the moment when Barry comes onto their screens and where there's this real readiness for people who already were right-wing, right? A lot of the people at the Founders Fund that's run by Peter Thiel, or people who were sort of experiencing their own radicalization, right? This would be a lot of folks over at, I think, Y Combinator, for instance. They were ready to kind of hear these messages. Famously, Musk is someone who reached out to Peter Thiel to sort of go on that black pill journey or whatever he's on now, right? I mean, Nicole Shanahan, RFK Jr.'s...
one-time running mate, yeah.
Yeah, sort of got radicalized during COVID. She's the ex-wife of one of the Google founders. So she was at the right place at the right time, from what you're telling me.
Yeah, and I think you're right that these were rich people sort of primed to hear this anti-woke message by their own latent prejudices and by, you know, historical circumstances that had encouraged those prejudices or encouraged them to think of them as righteous.
Well, the reason why sort of cancel culture and anti-wokeness really worked for that set, and again, like the number of these people is not huge and they really are fairly uniform, is also because a lot of these people are getting older and are grappling with a life where the central fact, where the thing they're most famous for is that they got unbelievably lucky. And as someone who's getting older and got pretty lucky, I can tell you it's not fun to contemplate about the fact that like you kind of owe it all to chance. Mm. It's nice to think like, oh, I worked hard for it and I deserved it and other people didn't. And so that's always been the case. This kind of hierarchized thinking has always been attractive to the people who've succeeded beyond anyone's imagination, any measure in Silicon Valley. But it's harder the older you get. And a lot of these guys, as I say, were not like starting companies anymore. They were, if anything, ruining companies. They were playing tennis and like tweeting from the toilet, basically. And to have someone be like, no, those now in charge should not be in charge. You ought to be, you did it the right way. Like that's fucking opium to these people.
Yeah. And so like, even though this was a population sort of primed to receive this anti-woke message, we should credit Barry and say that she was a pretty skilled messenger.
Yeah.
So when Barry was forging her career as a right-wing provocateur at the New York Times in sort of the late 2010s, 2017 to 2020, one of the things you would consistently hear from her defenders is that she is really, really nice.
Yeah.
So you'd see like the likes of Katie Royfe or Bill Maher make this point in public. But in private, I would hear it from all kinds of like Gen X media elites, right? My boss, back when I worked at, you know, Redacted magazine in 2017, once made a point of telling us all that he had met her at the home of one of his friends and found her incredibly gracious and charming, even though he claimed he did not share her politics. So we've talked about how Barry isn't really good on camera. She's kind of stiff. She doesn't have a lot of like charisma on a screen. But it has to be said that she is very, very good at a room. She has a gift for making people feel seen and important. And she is, by all accounts, just interpersonally lovely, generous, gracious, attentive, warm. Like, I do not doubt that Barry possesses these qualities. I'm sure if I ever met her, as I never, ever will, I would be charmed, right? I also think that that charm is most powerful and most efficacious on people who are already sort of interested in her politics and in her message.
Yeah.
And I think she deploys her charm deliberately and strategically for the sake of furthering her agenda. Mm. If she has a gift, this is it. It's for strategically charming people who can be useful to her.
The talented Mrs. Weiss. You know who else this is true of? I once met John Kerry, and it finally made sense to me why the Democrats made him this incredibly stiff candidate in 2004. It's like, if you're in the room with him, you're like, oh, this guy has tons of charisma. And then you zoom out and you see him on camera, you're like, oh, weird. None of that translates. It is a thing, right? Because like, of course, people in the room are a big part of making the decisions.
Yeah.
And then maybe when they even watch someone on TV, they're like, well, this is still the same person that I interacted with and I loved it. But it's very different for those of us who have never interacted with this person in close quarters. I don't know, like, does she put a spell on you or something? What's going on here?
It's actually really professionally important to be a good hang.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to have a good vibe. And apparently she does. It's atrocious in every exposure I've had to her. But by all accounts, in a room, she's very, very different.
That's why podcasting is the medium for us.
Yeah.
I'm immediately off-putting, but no one knows because I come to them only through their AirPods.
So she's a charmer, right? And she starts charming at these dinner parties in LA in the early 2020s as she's looking to expand her newsletter into something more like a newsroom. So at the end of 2021, she raises over $1 million in funding almost all of it from these conservative Silicon Valley billionaires, including the big pro-Trump guys, David Sachs and Mark Andreessen, and the former Starbucks CEO, Howard Schultz.
Oh, interesting.
Remember Howard Schultz? He was a Starbucks guy and he ran like a brief, like centrist campaign for the Democratic primary in 2020 and then had the good sense to back out. But he did not have the good sense to not give hundreds of thousands of dollars to Barry Weiss.
It's interesting, right? Like, we can talk about the affinity of these people for Barry Weiss's politics. I think that's totally fair. At the same time, we should also say that raising $1 million in funding from David Sachs and Mark Andreessen is, frankly, that's peanuts for them. They probably shit out like 35 times that for like some weird startup idea that someone like wrote down on a cocktail napkin, right?
Right. I mean, consider she is at the end of 2021 raising $1 million in funding, or just over $1 million in funding. And in 2024, I believe, she will sell her company to the Ellisons for $150 million, right? So this is something that grows very, very fast.
Yeah.
So in early 2022, Common Sense rebrands as the Free Press. She hires a bunch more employees and starts churning out a truly staggering amount of content.
How big is the Free Press? Like, how many people are working there?
By the time Barry went to CBS News, which has a couple of thousand employees, the Free Press had 60 employees.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. So it was a big jump for her in terms of managing a much bigger newsroom at the end of 2025. But it was a decently sized, like small but significant newsroom of its own. I mean, and I'm saying newsroom in quotes because really the Free Press remains an opinion outlet, right?
Yeah. Wait, of those 60, for how many of those reporters is their entire beat just scrolling through Zoran Mamdani's Twitter feed?
Oh my God. But she does expand really quickly from just being, you know, a text-based web platform into video and podcasts. She launches a personal podcast called Honestly with Barry Weiss, which is a big hit. It's an interview show where she talks to truly a shocking number of major figureheads. And some of them are people we'd think of on like the broad far to center right. So like Peter Thiel, Jonathan Haidt, and Amy Coney Barrett have all been on her podcast. But it's also people who are just kind of apolitical. Like she had Kim Kardashian on.
Oh, wow.
So her subscription base expands and so does her funding, right? She keeps raising money.
Yeah.
Adrian, last week, and actually earlier on this podcast, you described Barry as a benefit of Wingnut Welfare, somebody who got hired by an institution when she came to the Times because she was conservative and because conservatives are seen as necessary to boost a mainstream publication's credibility, even when their writing or thinking is not up to the standards that would otherwise be expected of those organizations.
Yeah.
But here, I think we really see Barry starting to transform into a vehicle, giving Wingnut Welfare out to others.
Yeah, she's a garden hose.
Yeah, she's hiring prodigiously. She's commissioning pieces across the spectrum of conservative thought for the Free Press. And she's able to do all that because she has a lot of these rich men's money to play with. So she is a valve through which conservative billionaires are funding what they hope will be a right-wing cultural and political shift. She is the tool of the right-wing elite that they are using for that purpose. And I think the way she hands out these kind of employment favors is conspicuous. So we also discussed in our episodes on the Epstein files how cancellation and sexual misconduct allegations during this period became through a kind of conservative network of the sort that Barry is really good at creating and navigating, a way for accused men to actually access new professional opportunities. So when Barry is going on this hiring spree at the Free Press, she's hiring canceled men. One thing that really jumped out to me is that when Barry wanted to launch her podcast, she didn't hire any one of the, trust me, many, many talented radio and audio producers who are out there looking for work. She hired Andy Mills, who is a former producer of the New York Times podcast, The Daily, who had resigned from the New York Times following sexual harassment allegations.
Oh, wow.
So to Barry, what we would call bad behavior is something that she would call cancellation. And to her, that's a credential.
Yeah, I mean, that's how the University of Austin functions, I think, right? It's just people who've gotten into trouble out of the universities.
Oh, trust me, we will get there.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
So it's often said, including by us, that Barry's signature political posture, this brand of reactionary centrism in which she casts the right as victims of an overzealous left-wing cultural dominance, but does not herself actually avow a right-wing cultural agenda, we've said that this doesn't actually have a big audience, right?
Yeah.
And I would like to draw your attention to this quote from a Variety profile.
She plays to an audience of 200 people, says one Hollywood executive with ties to Weiss. It just happens to be that audience is made up of people like Jeff Bezos and Bill Ackman. The super rich fucking love her. Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, right. Like, this is a ideology that really appeals to a bunch of people who've got tons of money and basically nobody else, right?
Yeah. Good read, Hollywood executive with ties to Weiss.
But it has to be said, I think, like, if we're going to be fair to Barry, that the free press does have a big audience. By the end of 2024, the free press had over 136,000 paid subscribers. Mm-hmm. That's more than a lot of magazines. That's more than a lot of newspapers. They're doing well.
That's more than this podcast. And I got to tell you, if you're listening to this and you're not subscribed, like and subscribe.
Yeah, find us on Patreon. Yeah. Rate and review us. Give us one, like, fraction of Barry Weiss. Let us make what Barry Weiss finds in her couch cushions.
Yeah.
But, like, this is all to say that somebody really is buying what she's selling, right?
I've met them.
And that begs the question, what is Barry actually selling at the Free Press? I would like to posit that Barry is actually quietly abandoning what were always pretty flimsy claims to liberal cultural values and Trump skepticism. I think now the free press has managed to expand, not just because of these billionaire subsidies that Barry has, but because it is de facto a pro-MAGA outlet.
Yeah.
It's very different in style, but not really that different in substance from the rest of the right-wing media market, from places like Fox News or Breitbart or even like OANN. And to make this argument, I'm going to look at some of the things that the Free Press is actually publishing. So let's look at three major pieces that have been put up by the Free Press during its tenure. Adrian.
All right.
What is this?
Long-time listeners can try to take bets right now in their head as to what I might be about to read. Yes, this is the op-ed that we've talked about probably four or five times on this podcast already. Jamie reads, "I thought I was saving trans kids. Now I'm blowing the whistle," from February 9th, 2023. Liberals are transing your kids, guys. You learned it, well, not here, but you learned it on the Free Press first.
Well, I don't think this was first, right? I think this was kind of, you know, we talked about how Barry was a pioneer of the cancel culture panic article. And this is the Free Press also sort of making a major entry into what is by this point an established genre,
yeah,
which is the trans kids have gone too far, or like the liberals are going to trans your children, right?
Yeah.
So this is a as told to first person piece from a woman named Jamie Reed, who worked as a case manager at a St. Louis gender clinic that was affiliated with Washington University. And she claims that children at that clinic were being rushed into medical transition without psychiatric evaluation, even when they had comorbidities that would discourage gender-affirming care treatment, right? So she's like, these kids are not actually trans. They're just mentally ill, which is, you know, I think something in the transphobic imagination that's like kind of a category collapse anyway. But she says we are administering gender-affirming care at these clinics when what we should be doing is administering like psychiatric interventions that would discourage this kind of identification or might like resolve it otherwise, right?
Yeah. Also called conversion therapy.
Conversion therapy. Yeah. She does not call it that, but that's one way to describe it. So patients and parents from this clinic dispute Reed's claims. They say that they were actually given extensive psychological counseling and evaluation before accessing, you know, cross-gender hormones or referrals for surgeries. And an investigation was launched by Washington University itself into the practice of the clinic after Reed's allegations. And that investigation found the claims unsubstantiated. But that didn't really matter.
No.
Because by then, the piece in the Free Press had already been used by the Republican Attorney General to launch an investigation into the clinic. And by August, which is just 6 months after Barry publishes this piece in the Free Press, Missouri has passed a law banning medical transition for minors.
Yeah, and I mean, this is not kind of a silly culture war story. Like, kids are suffering because of this stupid story, because of these stupid lies. One reason I believe we gave it the Kirsty the year it came out.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of these like culture war stories actually wind up inflicting a lot of suffering on people who are different and are made not into people, but into symbols of these other unrelated grievances by people who don't know them. That's something Barry is very good at doing.
Yeah.
So then I wanted to...
Speaking of which...
I wanted to draw your attention to another major piece that they publish, just under a year later in January 2024.
Yes. What Really Happened to George Floyd by Coleman Hughes. So this is the... George Floyd died of an overdose or maybe a heart attack or something other than, you know, Derek Chauvin smothering him by kneeling on his neck, right? That's that piece?
Yeah. So this is Coleman Hughes on some inconvenient reporting that suggests Derek Chauvin is not a murderer, but a scapegoat.
Oh.
So this is a Free Press piece by Coleman Hughes, a sort of like right-wing or like anti-racist black writer. And it's put out as part of a press rollout for a documentary called The Fall of Minneapolis, which is a movie that seeks to advance the notion that George Floyd was not murdered, but died of natural causes, and to recast the Black Lives Matter uprisings of the summer of 2020 as like this moral panic of the left in a violent frenzy.
Yeah, The Fall of Minneapolis, oddly enough, was tons of neighbors getting together, marching for police accountability. It was not, I'm guessing, the U.S. government sending an invasive force trying to abduct children at the local Kroger's.
No. That's all well and good.
Yeah, that's fine.
So this piece gets debunked on like pretty straightforward factual terms. Like the trans piece, it was sort of subject to an outcry. But then Radley Balco, who's a libertarian journalist and a critic of police power, really not a woke ideologue by any stretch of the imagination, but like a guy who had an interest in the story, let's say. He did a long series of, I think it was 3 articles, thoroughly debunking every single claim in the documentary and in Hughes' piece and establishing, to my mind, really beyond a doubt, that George Floyd was indeed murdered, right?
Yeah.
Like with the trans teen story, again, the Free Press does not retract the Coleman Hughes article when it is shown to make these demonstrably false claims. Instead, Weiss tries to, like, get more content out of the controversy. She invites Balco onto her podcast. To his great credit, he declines.
This is the evolution playbook, right? Like, teach the controversy. Like, let's get a creationist in there. It's such a shitty game to play, and I'm glad that Radley Balco didn't go for it.
So, Adrian, what is this third piece?
The third piece, is hard to put into words. This is Olivia Rheingold and Tanya Lukyanova. They became symbols for Gazan starvation, but all 12 suffer from other health problems. This is the Gazan children are not being starved, or are not starving technically, which means that Israel did nothing wrong in causing their deaths.
So this piece was published in August 2025, about 2 years into Israel's genocidal war on Gaza. And it is responding to a New York Times piece documenting the starvation deaths of children, as the Gazans, of whom there were at the start of the war about 2 million, their population is dwindling and is being subjected to a really brutal blockade that has created famine conditions. And it really kind of shocks the conscience. The argument here is that these children had pre-existing conditions and hence their deaths of starvation should not be blamed on or seen to reflect on Israeli conduct.
Yeah.
This is just a piece that I really think, like, I don't know how to talk in a way that won't, like, undermine my credibility, but I don't think you should be allowed to work again or, like, show your face in public again if you try to justify the starvation of children. Like, this is really just egregiously morally depraved in a way that I don't find just, like, stupid or annoying, but, like, actively sick.
And it gives you a good sense of the reach of the Free Press, because this reporting, as far as I know, got repeated ad nauseum in especially the European press, which of the 80,000 people subscribed to the Free Press, probably like 10,000 are European news editors, and they all repeated these claims. And then again, this was also, well, not so much story debunked, but that people said like, well, yeah, like, of course, in a famine situation, people with pre-existing conditions do tend to die first. And not really sure if that's the dunk that you think it is. That's why you don't starve civilian populations, because there are vulnerable people in every civilian population and you shouldn't be killing them.
Yeah, you think that they died because we're starving them, but little did you know they actually died because they have pre-existing conditions that we're also not allowing them to treat, right? It does not make the Israelis look good.
Yeah.
And so, like, this is the kind of stuff that the Free Press is putting out, right? And I think one answer to the question of, like, okay, well, if Barry Weiss's reactionary centrism doesn't have a constituency, why is the Free Press doing so well? Is that, like, that's not actually her politics.
Yeah.
Right? These are not, to me, like, daringly heterodox, boldly centrist ideas.
Yeah.
These are not ideas that challenge, as Barry Weiss has claimed to challenge, the excesses of both the left and the right.
Right.
To me, these are bog standard conservative pieces. They target minorities and disfavored populations, and they justify violence against those populations.
Yeah.
So Barry is not challenging an ideology at the Free Press. She is conforming to one.
Yeah, in slightly smarter, slightly more knowledgeable ways than you might at OANN, right? But like, it's the same playbook, but in kinder language.
They're just wearing business casual. That's all it is.
Yeah. Napa casual, Maura. Napa casual.
So Barry has also, we should say, become much less vocally anti-Trump. During her years at the Times, she was critical of the president. Now she's come to kind of cautiously embrace him. In 2025, she says that she used to have Trump derangement syndrome and has suggested that left responses to Donald Trump are more dangerous than Trump himself. Trump, meanwhile, has come to affirmatively like and praise Barry Weiss. He has sung her praises effusively in public.
That's right.
So now, Adrian, and this might seem like a little bit of a detour, but we have to talk about the school that Barry founded.
Sort of.
Because I don't think any real history of Barry's career would be complete without addressing the institution that cites her as one of its founders and has a marble bust of her face in its library. Have you seen this artifact?
I saw this. It is wild.
It is so weird. It's the University of Austin is an institution in Texas. It's basically housed out of an office building. It's very small. It is as yet not accredited. It is sort of right-wing startup institution. And in their library, they have a marble bust of none other than Barry Weiss, her bespectacled face. I gotta say, it's weird to see a marble bust and know that the face depicted there, it looks like it's seen an iPhone. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, the most terminally online person in the world is now here immortalized in a marble bust, like way far beyond the dignity that she deserves. So, Adrian, what is the University of Austin?
So it was launched the way most great American universities are, on Substack. No, it started as an article on the Free Press in October 2021, which is something like, America's universities and colleges are broken, so we're starting a new one.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you always know that your foundation has great dignity when you're using the standard editorial format of clickbait to announce the formation of the school. It was started by Pano Canellos, the former president of St. John's College in Annapolis, which is a famous great books school. Great books is something that conservatives profess to love. And listeners will remember the Wall Street Journal article that Barry Weiss wrote about how to survive the PC university. The whole thing premised on the idea that the famous class is called the Forbidden Courses or something like that, or Forbidden Texts. And I've seen the list, and it's all texts that, I mean, I would say I've taught 80% of those texts. It's like the Federalist Papers on there. Like, yeah, gee, that's real fucking forbidden. I might be shocked if anyone at Stanford taught that anymore. But it's like the University of Austin sort of comes out of a headspace, again, of people who have pretty distorted view, frankly, of what university instruction looks like right now, and in whose mind Shakespeare's is no longer taught in the academy because it's all been replaced by, I don't know, Alice Walker, right?
The way that these people fear Alice Walker.
It's very funny.
What did The Color Purple ever do to you?
I mean, in my book, I show that like they haven't updated that talking point for like 35 years. Like Alice Walker is probably not taught at all anymore on college campuses.
But it's the only black woman they can think of who like wrote a book, you know?
Well, I think they don't want to say Toni Morrison because then it's like, well, it's actually really fucking good.
They can't argue with Toni Morrison, but they feel like they could win an argument against Alice Walker.
Which is also wrong, but, you know, still, it's like that maybe they like their chances. The University of Austin is also, of course, another invitation for the same deep-pocketed donors that made the Free Press what it is to basically sink more money into a right-wing counter institution. It's another way to sort of pull down Silicon Valley billionaire money. It is currently, and again, like this happens to many a storied institution after they've been around for a couple of hundred years, it seems to be riven with some infighting and some disagreements over strategy and vision, which cynics, not me, but cynics might say is what happens when you base your entire educational model on a bizarre paranoid fantasy. And also, we should say that in a truly shocking turn, this school that was founded to give a landing pad to academics and to students who had not been allowed to say what they wanted to say and who would be unafraid to engage with challenging ideas seems to be undone slightly by people being told what to say and not to say, and people also being triggered by things that happen on campus.
Yeah, you know, so this university, such as it is currently imploding because some of the people who originally signed on, thinking it was going to be a bastion of free speech, are now shocked to discover that it's actually a right-wing partisan outfit. And a couple of other people were really outraged when a student who exhibited some kind of misbehavior on campus was dismissed without what they thought was an adequate due process for his rights. So, you know, the actual realities of running a functioning institution are running up against these people's desires to like sort of grandstand and post a lot.
Yeah.
But, you know, this was a university that, as you said, Adrian, was conceived as sort of a alternative to what they believed were the supposed liberal consensus on elite campuses. And it was conceived by Weiss, by Pano Canellos, the former Great Book scholar, the right-wing historian Niall Ferguson, and billionaire Palantir founder Joe Lonsdale. Supposedly, they all had a meeting in Austin. They all agreed to do this together.
The founder of the Cicero Institute. Yeah, Niall Ferguson has been at Stanford for quite a while. And in fact, the speech that he was told not to engage in was, hey, let's spy on students who disagree with us. That's the kind of free speech shit that the University of Austin stands for.
This is the classic Barry Weiss definition of free speech, which is that nobody who disagrees with her ever gets to talk back.
Yeah.
And, you know, as you said, Adrian, they offer an academic program that they label the Forbidden Courses.
Forbidden Courses.
And then it's just like, it's fucking like Plato.
Yeah, I know. Not the Theaetetes. Richard III? Only the second is allowed at the woke university.
When he runs in holding the chicken and saying, behold a man, like nobody at the woke universities will be able to handhold that joke.
That's right.
So I think this branding of the Forbidden Courses, to me, it echoes the piece Barry did at the New York Times on the quote-unquote intellectual dark web, right?
Yeah.
It's an attempt to cast conservatism as transgressive and forbidden and sexy. This move to start the University of Austin also echoes for me, again, this strategic divide in Barry's career regarding her relationship to institutions, right? Because on the one hand, you see her building these alternative conservative institutions like the Free Press as an alternative to the Times and the University of Austin as sort of like an alternative to Columbia or like a version of what she wished she'd gotten at Columbia. But her real desire, I think, is to capture and defeat these institutions and to make them hers.
Yeah.
So this is like a consolation prize or a substitute a little bit, which might explain why she kind of seems to abandon it. Like, it's not actually clear how much Barry was really involved in the running of the University of Austin.
Yeah.
Or whether she simply kind of served as a connector of these money reactionaries and right-wing cranks, right? That's her great talent, is sort of introducing reactionaries with money to reactionaries with nutso ideas. And that seems to be more or less what she did with the University of Austin. But the school really does trade on her imprimatur. It cites her as one of their founders. It's got her bust in the library. They're talking about Barry Weiss as the kind of person they're trying to imitate, the kind of mind they're trying to create more of.
That sounds like a threat.
So that brings us to CBS.
Yes. The University of Austin of TV networks.
So in 2025, Barry has just completed a $15 million round of funding for the Free Press. And the company in that funding round was advertising its own value at $100 million. A father and son pair called the Ellisons sweep in and they buy it at a overvalued $150 million. Adrian, who are Larry and David Ellison?
So Larry Ellison is the founder of Oracle and his son is his son. That appears to be his the beginning and the end of his qualifications for anything. There's also a daughter in there, Megan Ellison, who seems to be like comparatively normal. But basically, Larry and David are big Trumpy tech guys.
Yeah. Larry Ellison is, I think, about Trump's age or maybe a little older. He founded Oracle, which is a tech company, made a ton of money off of it. He looks like a ham wearing a fake mustache. He's one of these guys who's really disfigured himself with plastic surgery and looks really grotesque.
If Florida were your uncle, if the state of Florida were your uncle, that's what you're picturing when you picture Larry Ellison.
And his son, David, has decided to take his father's money and use it to consolidate a media empire. So in 2025, the Ellisons were negotiating with their media holding company, Skydance, to buy Paramount, which is a massive media conglomerate that, among other things, houses CBS and CBS News. You might remember, listeners, that Donald Trump had sued CBS over a editing of an interview they did with Kamala Harris during the 2024 election, a really frivolous lawsuit, right? But as this merger is pending and as Trump-appointed regulators have the power to either stop it or put it through, CBS settles that lawsuit and pays Donald Trump what Stephen Colbert classifies as, quote unquote, a big fat bribe, in order to allow the merger to happen and get the Redstone family to be able to sell Paramount to the Ellisons. As part of that deal, as something that is explicitly meant to sweeten the deal and give Donald Trump a prize, the Ellisons posit that they are going to bring in Barry Weiss and make her the editor-in-chief of CBS News, and she will be tasked to basically everyone's acknowledgement with shifting the editorial direction of CBS further to the right and making it more favorable to Donald Trump.
Right.
And she sets about doing so. It should be said that this is cause for a big revolt at CBS News. CBS News is a place where a lot of serious journalists work.
Yeah.
It is the home of 60 Minutes. It's the home of people who do investigative reporting. Barry has no experience, as we covered, doing investigative reporting.
Well, she does have experience live tweeting meetings that people like that have while she's sitting in the back. Yeah.
But, you know, it's kind of immediately a disaster. She wears a baseball cap to work. She's being trailed by security, even in the office, which people at CBS find really insulting. They're like, what does she think? We're going to kill her. She is taking a private plane everywhere, which is costing the network a ton of money. And she ends her first editorial meeting by saying, let's do the fucking news, which is like a Brett Kavanaugh, like doing a keg stand kind of a posture. You know, it's just, it's really boorish and silly and not equal to the dignity of the work that these people are trying to do. So one thing that's happening right now is CBS is still hemorrhaging talent.
Yeah.
There are no journalism jobs. These people have nowhere to go. They are still trying to leave because they can't do the work that would allow them to continue to respect themselves and be of service to the public under her leadership.
Yeah.
So a lot of people are leaving. And one of the things that really seems to spur a ton of people to leave is a decision Barry makes to pull a segment from CBS at the last minute. Do you know anything about this?
Yeah, this is the Inside CECOT story, right?
That's right.
It was a report from the El Salvadoran prison that DHS uses to house detainees, so our neighbors. And basically, Barry's story either is shifting or it's just incoherent in itself. He's like, this came together too quickly and we didn't really fact check it well enough, which everyone at CBS is like, that's bullshit. But also we need to consult with the Trump administration and get more of basically their talking heads on tape before we can air this. And it's noticeable, right? Like almost certainly CBS fact checking would have reached out to the White House. And I am sure, I guess I'm not a White House reporter, but I'm guessing that the final paragraph of that email is, as always, if you'd like to go on camera and respond to this, we, of course, would be happy to set something up. You can text me at blah, 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 right? So the whole thing sort of feels like it's a performance for someone who has no media knowledge. Like, I'm not exactly a media insider. And I was like, wow, there's like four ways that this is bullshit. So not only does it gets shit canned in this way that's almost deliberately unsubtle. This was not smooth operation. This wasn't like, oh, wow, well played, Barry. It was, Jesus Christ, like there was probably a way to kill this in a kind of underhanded and sneaky way, but you just went for, I mean, for the Trumpiest way possible, right? Here are two mutually contradictory reasons why we shouldn't do this. Oh, also the third reason she gave was, oh, it's all kind of old news. So it's like, okay, so they're supposed to be able to respond to it. It's not fact-checked enough and it's old news. Great, wow. Three things that can definitely be true at once, Barry. Great job.
Yeah, so this piece got pulled. I think it's pretty clear because it made the Trump administration look bad. And Barry understands her purview at CBS News to be to limit coverage that makes the Trump administration look bad. And that is especially true because the Ellisons are not done purchasing media companies. They are not done trying to consolidate their control over the media. They are still seeking regulatory approval from the Trump administration because now they're looking to buy Warner Brothers. Do you know anything about this potential merger?
Not much. All I know is that Warner has been trying to get bought for a little while now. Netflix was very interested, and Trump very clearly does not want Netflix to buy it. And the Ellisons are very interested in it. And of course, this would place the maybe other flagship TV investigative reporting outfit in the United States, namely CNN, under their thumb as well, and possibly under Barry's too.
Yes, Barry is also being looked at for an editorial role at CNN. So part of what's happening here is that MAGA is consolidating its control over the mainstream media outlets. And they are using Barry to make sure that those outlets do not publish things that they do not find flattering or convenient, right? So there is sort of a foreclosure of different points of view from these mainstream outlets, from these elite media institutions, and a ideological narrowing towards only the right wing. So Barry has become the primary instrument of exactly the phenomenon that she started her career out purporting to object to.
Yeah.
She said there was too much ideological conformity, and now she is the tool enforcing ideological conformity under an authoritarian would-be dictatorship across national media. It is pretty perfect, folks.
Well, except that I'm not even sure she would see the contradiction, because I think she's always been fine with ideological echo chambers and ideological conformity so long as it also conforms to her sense of how things ought to be and who matters and who doesn't. I mean, what's really telling there is her choice for CBS Evening News anchor, right? Tony Dokupil, who I think was picked on the merits of one single exchange in an interview, right? This was about a September 2024 interview about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict with Ta-Nehisi Coates, where Dokupil did things that Barry Weiss loves and that it turns out Summer Redstone and the Ellisons also loved, which is to say he challenged a black guy. He basically accused someone reporting and describing the Israeli attack on Gaza and on the West Bank as essentially being akin to hate speech. He called it extremist. And it turned out, interestingly enough, an internal review, I believe, at CBS found that it did not, in fact, meet editorial standards for the company. That is catnip to one Barry Weiss, right? It's the kind of truth-telling she likes, one that flatters her own prejudices and her own view of the world.
It would be easy to leave it there, but I did want to dwell for a second on what the future might look like for Barry, because she is at a crossroads now, too. She built her career and her public persona by claiming to be this embattled outsider, an underdog, going up against these bigger institutions and these bigger cultural shifts. She really can't do that anymore. You know, Donald Trump is in power and she's the editorial director of CBS. She can no longer be the scrappy outsider. She can no longer claim victimization from these big cultural forces. It doesn't mean she won't try, but I don't think it's credible. I think it's even less credible now, right? But also, and I think this is like delicate but real, I'm wondering how Barry, who has invested so much in her Jewish identity and specifically in her Zionism, will fit herself into a changing right wing. Because is there really room right now on today's right for a Jewish leader or a Zionist leader in a movement that is increasingly embracing an anti-Semitic style of white nationalism?
Yeah.
So like Tucker Carlson, one of the avatars of the like newly avowed anti-Semitic right, absolutely hates Barry Weiss. He called her mediocre and said that her ascent is only possible in a rigged world, which, you know.
Yeah, wow.
I might have different rationales for why, but it is a little bit of like a soft clock is right twice a day situation.
Yes, but when Tucker Carlson says rigged, you also have to, you know, the footnote is to the Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
Yes, so exactly, yeah.
I guess you do not have to hand it to him, in fact.
I don't think the world is rigged the way that Tucker Carlson thinks it's rigged,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
But I think this is a moment where Barry is sort of at a crossroads. She made her career as an anti-woke attack dog under the premise that she was fighting anti-Semitism, under the premise that anti-Zionism was a kind of anti-Semitism and therefore had to be rooted out. And how is she going to deal with that now that the anti-woke world where she's made her career is increasingly embracing anti-Semitism?
Yeah.
Well, one strategy she might take is to just go ahead and embrace anti-Semites herself. And this is where I want to draw your attention, Adrian, to somebody named James Fishback. Do you know who this guy is?
I don't know.
James Fishback is a 31-year-old Florida financier who is running currently, as we record, in the Florida Republican gubernatorial primary. James Fishback is a griper, and he is a pretty avowed anti-Semite. So one of the things he does is talk about, like he tweeted about like goy slop. He's like, oh, school lunches are goy slop, alluding to a conspiracy theory that Jewish people like control the food supply and give non-Jewish people like unhealthy food to keep them like fat and lazy. He is a stark anti-Israel critic in a way where, you know, like anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism are not the same thing, but his are, you know, and
right.
James Fishback is a guy whose criticism of Israel is not based in like humanitarian concerns for the rights of Palestinians, but in like anti-Semitic concerns about like the nefarious power of Jews. And this is also a guy who got his start launching his like public persona on the right. He's also, sorry, I should say, he's a follower of Nick Fuentes and an avatar of the Groiper movement within the Republican Party, which is very, very anti-Semitic as well as racist and misogynist. But he is a guy who got his start, really kind of launched his public platform on the Free Press. So I want you to just look at this bit of text that I've highlighted, a Free Press article from 2023.
By him. At high school debates, debate is no longer allowed. At national tournaments, judges are making their stances clear. Students who argue capitalism can reduce poverty or Israel has a right to defend itself will lose. No questions asked. Huh.
Yeah, so this is catnip to Barry Weiss. It's about a school. It's about the concept of conservatives being bullied. It's stupid and about children, right? It's a stupid thing about high school. So Barry loves it. It was catnip to her. This piece went really, really viral, actually. and it was a big hit for the Free Press. He later wrote follow-up articles and several more pieces in the Free Press as part of how he built his following. So Fishback is primarily a financier. That's like most of his money making. But he also started a school debate nonprofit, Incubate Debate. And this was a Florida-based nonprofit that helped to cultivate like high school debate teams in sort of like conservative style.
God, it's like, so you're telling me it's a tech bro who loves debate teams from Florida. So it's like, this is like really like the bingo card for I do not want to meet this person. I got to be honest with you.
Yeah, and he also hates Jewish people, thinks they rule the world, wants a total moratorium on immigration, various sexist policies. But he has this Incubate Debate nonprofit, right? The Broward County School District severed its ties with Incubate Debate in 2022. Can you guess why?
I'm going to say because they proposed a debate about whether the Holocaust happened.
No.
Bah.
Allegations that Fishback had an inappropriate sexual relationship with a 17-year-old girl.
The other one.
Yeah.
It's either Holocaust denial or Epstein Island. It's just like it's...
It was a coin flip. It could have gone either way.
Fuck.
Now he is running a really avowedly racist and anti-Semitic campaign for Florida governor. And I would like you to see this tweet that he put up just a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, yeah. It is from @J_Fishback. A blue check, so you know this guy sucks. Great to catch up with the incredible at Barry Weiss tonight in D.C.
So this is a picture of James Fishback, who, again, is an anti-Semite who believes that like Jewish people are secretly controlling the world, having a warm conversation with Barry, who is looking at him like he is a little puppy. I mean, find somebody who looks at you the way Barry Weiss is looking at this Nazi in this picture. So, you know, that's all, folks. I think Barry is here to stay for a little while. I think we've got a little more time seeing how far she manages to fall upwards and what her career will look like. But I think that it is fair to say of Barry Weiss that she will never, ever surprise you.
I mean, there's one possibility, right? As you were describing it, she runs institutions while also positioning herself as this kind of inveterate outsider of these institutions. She also seems to be destroying these institutions, right? I mean, the Free Press is still doing well, but like University of Austin isn't doing so hot. I don't think CBS is going to really thrive under her leadership. So person runs the institution into the ground while also positioning themselves as an outsider and like never takes any responsibility for what happens at that institution. Might Barry be shattering the last glass ceiling and just become Donald J. Trump?
Our first female president.
Oh, God. Moira, we're going to be fucked.
Thank you for coming along on this insane journey with me. I do really appreciate In Bed With The Right and all of our listeners who make this possible for giving me the opportunity to just be like a really dedicated and detail-oriented hater. I feel like it's my true calling.
Oh, yeah.
And I really got to shine, I feel, in these episodes.
This was a A-plus hateration.
I have the talent for hating Barry Weiss that Barry Weiss has for charming billionaires.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, our talents are just hateration and hollerations in any dancery, really, that you want to offer us. Anyway, see you guys next time on In Bed With The Right.
Thank you for listening.
In Bed With The Right is made possible by hundreds of listeners who support us via patreon.com. Our episodes are produced and edited by Mark Yoshizumi and Katie Lau. Our title music is by Katie Lau.